experience right now, 15 minutes. Speaker now shares. I guess that's me, right?
Yeah. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic.
Russell!
I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't found it necessary to have a drink since January 25th, 1981, and I'm tremendously grateful for that. And it's a privilege and a great opportunity to be here and share with you. I've been coming out here for many years, 27, 30 years, and I usually go to a little group, the Palisades group over there. And, you know, I love men's meetings. I was remarking before I, you know, while I was sitting there, that there's something about, you know, in the big book it says we welcome everybody no matter how long they've gone to, as long as they mean business. And as much as I love the ladies, there's something about a men's meeting where it seems like you really get down to business. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I know I was probably before booze addicted to the broads. And my sponsor used to say, underneath every skirt is a slip, you know, and I just love them women. I was sitting in a meeting one time when I first came in, and I said, look at that blonde in the front row. And he said, you know, Russell, what did you used to drink? And I said, I used to drink scotch. He said, what kind? I said, J&B. He said, you see that gal in the front row? I said, yeah. He says, you know, that's a bottle of J&B with legs for you.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, I sort of chuckled, but I'll tell you what happened to me. I so much didn't want to drink. I wanted to drink more than I wanted sex. I wanted to not drink more than I wanted. I wanted to not drink so badly that after that, I swear to God, every time I would see a good looking gal, I mean, I'd look at her for a moment or two and see how good looking she was, and then all of a sudden a green bottle would form around her body. I mean, that thing sort of stuck to me, even with today. So I'm going to try to share with you just a few stories. You know, in the time we have, I'll just tell you two or three stories about, because that's what this is about. It's about our personal stories. I want to try to be as transparent as possible. So the best way to do it is just be honest about a couple things that have happened to me before, during, and after, and what's going on with me today. And, you know, I don't need any script for this or any notes, because I was actually there when it happened most of the time. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I'm 63 years old. You know, I told you I haven't had a drink for a while, and been married 31 years to the Queen of Al-Anon, Our Ladies of Professional, Perpetual Revenge. And I've got three daughters, a son, and six grandkids, and I was sober most, if not all, the time for those kids, and they're all doing great. And I have a little law office in Dade County, and I started off in the Dade County State's Attorney's Office as a division chief there, you know, prosecuting major crimes, and then I moved out. But that's a little bit of part of my story. But I think I want to share with you, I want to start off sort of like a little bit at the end. I came from an alcohol family, which isn't really important for this talk. I mean, I don't blame my mother, father, anybody for being an alcoholic. I think if you come from an alcohol family where it's 3 o'clock in the morning, the screaming is going on, it probably hurts you a little bit more in the self-esteem category, although most alcoholics pretty much think they're pieces of shit, even though they'll tell you that they're fantastic and they don't care what other people think about them. We know that the one thing I've learned is I used to think, before I came here, that nobody's like me, nobody can understand me, I'm totally unique. After many, many years, I now know that everybody is like me, and they think the same thoughts I have, and chances are, if I think them, you've thought them. And so I pretty much figure out the reason AA works is because we're all a bunch of twins, even though we look kind of different. So chances are, if I had some feelings and thoughts going on, you had the same thing. So if I just honestly try to be transparent and share with you what's going on, somebody's going to figure out something that we have in common. And the bottom line is, I think I'm going to start, you know, when I was 30. Now, I got to tell you the truth. My memory isn't that great, you know, and so if the timing doesn't match up, don't blame me. I'm trying to. I'm not going to get the dates and the times right, but I can tell you this. I graduated law school. I married a beautiful, beautiful gal, non-alcoholic. She was the one who would have a sip of wine, and then I would finish off her glass because there are kids starving in China or something like that. I had a beautiful child, a son. Before I was like 25 years old, I was the division chief in the state's attorney's office in Dade County, one of the largest prosecution offices there. I had a beautiful son. I had a beautiful house on the golf course, Lagourse. Golf course. I mean, I had whatever you're supposed to have or gather up around yourself to make you feel okay. And, you know, of course, I thought I was okay and pretty much a legend in my own mind. And one morning I was, I came out, I was about 70 pounds lighter than I am now. And she was just a wonderful gal. She really was. She is now. And I came out in my blue suit and my white shirt and my red tie and all set to drive across the causeway to go to work in the Dade County State Attorney's Office, and she looked at me and she said, I just want you to know, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. And it wasn't like she was starting a fight. She wasn't like that, you know. She wasn't a codependent, you know. I mean, she wasn't going to hang around. She was just basically, it was like she was delivering the mail. She just, it was sort of like, you know, well, she had something called self-esteem and shit like that, you know. And apparently, even though she loved me, she said, you know, that's it, you know. You know, the bill's got to be paid. It was just making an announcement. I just want you to know, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. That's 12, I counted it, it's 12 words. You know, there's no fat in that sentence. There's no, like, what do you take out? Like the if, you don't, you know? I graduated with departmental honors in mathematics. I was going for my PhD in algebraic topology. I'm not a stupid guy. You know what I mean? I figure a statement like that, that's like the statement when the judge says, you know, I see you one more time, you're going to jail, and you walk out and say, what the hell was that all about? You know? I think alcoholics are sort of idiot savants. I think we're sort of idiot savants, you know what I mean? We could be tremendous actors, lawyers, you know, mathematicians. We could be great singers, and just as a part of our lives, we're just fucking dumb, you know? And we just don't see it. And so that's what she said. You come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. I walked out the door, I drove to the first light, and I remember thinking this, what the hell did she mean by that? Now here's my theory on that. My theory on that is if you don't get, you come home drunk more time, I'm leaving you, mouthed by what should be the most important person in your life, you know what I mean? You're probably going to wind up in trouble down the road somewhere, you know? And you know, I many years after working with really, many years later after working with hundreds of men, who I've said similar things to. If you do this one more time, you do that, and it's like there's no light going on. I've now realized an alcoholic axiom that comes from that, and that is whenever an alcoholic hears, reads, or is told something he doesn't like, it confuses them. And they usually get mad and they cross you off the list and say screw you and, you know, go find somebody who tells them shit that makes them feel good, you know, and agrees with them. And now I understand that, you know, the messages are clear, we just don't hear the messages or we X them out. And of course I went to the bar and I told my best buddy, you know, I got to get home because Ronnie says you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. He said, he put his arm around me, he says, oh, you're a great guy, he's not going to do it, all that sort of stuff. So I had one drink. I said, no, I got to go. It's 4:30. You know, and I was right across the causeway, 15 minutes away, so I had one drink. I said, give me a double scotch. It was years later before I realized I started with two, and I whacked that down because I was a fast drinker. I didn't drink because I wanted to get to that place, that spot, you know what I mean? I was a whack. You know, I used to get a good feeling driving up to the bar, you know, like, you know, just getting there. And the next thing I know, it was 4 o'clock in the morning, they drove me home, and the next morning I was kicked out of my house. And that was the end of a 5-year marriage. Lost my house, my wife. Didn't lose it, just gave it away. And you know, for years, I'd like to say I was in alcohol coma. I didn't know that alcohol had anything to do with my divorce, because if you had asked me, why am I getting divorced, I would have said, we're growing in different directions. She doesn't understand me, she's trying to control me. And believe that shit. That's the scary part. And I was basically running the law office, trying first degree murder cases, in charge of 4 or 5 attorneys in a division, and I was basically doing a good job, and I had no clue. It wasn't until I was 6 months sober in Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm driving back from Palm Beach with my sponsor coming from a car auction, and he started telling me how he got divorced. Guess what? It was the same thing. Come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. I said, that's what happened to me, and I realized for the first time that not only did alcohol have something to do with my divorce, it was the reason I got divorced. She could have said a million things, but she said, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you, and that's why I got divorced, and I didn't realize it for years. All the things that happened because of that deal. So ultimately, I obviously got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just want to tell you a few stories. I've had 3 sponsors. They're all wonderful, wonderful men. Unfortunately, people ask me, we'd be a temporary sponsor. I said, I don't know how to make it permanent because we died. You know, 2 of them have passed away with many years of sobriety. And you like that? We died. Okay. That gets a laugh in this group. Well, actually dying, you know, I've had cancer a couple times. Actually, and I don't want to really get too far off the subject, being told you have cancer is a great way to get serious and cut out a lot of horseshit. And it's not that I wish cancer on every one of you, but a bunch of you are going to get it anyway. And you'll find that you stop worrying about the fucking car or the broads when you get it. You really will. Believe me, 90% of the bullshit. You know what I found out? 90% of the shit that I used to think about has absolutely nothing to do with me. Of the 10% that has to do with me, 95% of that I have no fucking control over. And you know, and the 5% that's left over, you know, probably isn't worth thinking about anyway, and so I've cut it all out, and I'll tell you, it helps a lot with the committee. It helps a lot with the committee when you do that. Because you don't have to think too much. You know, just have to focus on him. Doesn't say, see what your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. You know, anything you do to focus on him will stop you from focusing on her, or it, or them. And God knows they all make me nervous. So I just sort of think about him. I feel a lot better that way. So in any event, getting off the subject, in any event, I was unfortunately poorly sponsored. Albert Einstein was apparently dead. Jesus wasn't around. I couldn't find anybody. So they hooked me up with this used car salesman from Chicago who didn't even graduate sixth grade. And I showed him all my diplomas and my degrees. You know, and he looked at them on the wall. I said, look at all my degrees. He said, you know, Russ, rectal thermometers have degrees, and you know what they do with those. That's the way I've been treated all my life, you know. And, so I'm sitting with my sponsor. I just want to tell you a couple of stories about a couple of my sponsors, and I'm sitting because I learned a lot from these men, you know. And I'm just one of those guys. They say, you know, in the 12 and 12, the way we get a new perspective by 100 forms of humiliation and the final crushing of our self-sufficiency. And there's just something about, in order for me to eat the castor oil and learn a lesson, I just have to be cut down to size. Because I'm such an arrogant son of a bitch, you know what I mean? And I just have such my part of my mind tells me I'm the greatest in the world, I'm entitled. The other part of my mind tells me I'm a piece of shit. That sets up some sort of friction. I don't know what that is. And scotch usually helps that deal. It brings us all together. But you know, when you're not drinking, you're sort of confused and you're nervous. And I just had these guys, these sponsors that were wonderful men that you don't knew how to play me. And they knew how to be tough enough with me where they would hurt my feelings. You know, thank God, because they were more interested. They were sober. They were more interested in saving my soul than worrying about whether I liked them or not. And you know, if you're an alcoholic, you're please love me a holic. Why doesn't he like me a holic? You know, why are they saying those bad things about me a holic? You know, what can I do to fit in a holic? And what was that line that Marlon Brando said? If I go to a party and there's 300 people and one doesn't like me, I have to leave. You know, I'm the guy, I'm the alcoholic. When they say invite me to a party, who's going to be there? Because I got to know, because if it's somebody that I don't like, you know, I'm not going. You know, I mean, at the same time, I'm telling you that, you know, I don't worry about what people think about me. When my whole life is about what is he going to think of me, what is she going to think about me, what am I going to do, what's going to happen if I lose this, lose that, what are they going to, it's just a, man, I spend more money that I don't have buying things I don't need to impress people I don't like than you could possibly. I lost my credit cards when I was 9 years sober because apparently my sponsor explained to me when you spend more money than you make, you go into something called debt. Did you know that? I didn't know that shit, you know. And so anyway, I'm sitting with my sponsor, Bob Sullivan, my first one, right before a meeting, and I'm doing what I was a bar drinker. You know what bar drinkers do is I don't know how many bar drinkers we have in here, but you know, you sit around, you talk shit about other people. You just talk bad shit. You talk bad shit about other people behind their back. That's just what you do. I mean, you don't realize it's gossip or any of that stuff. And you just, that's, you know, and then when you stop talking, somebody else says, yeah, you're right. And says, let me tell you about this son of a bitch, you know. And you're talking about your boss or your wife or whatever the hell it is. And so it was the most natural thing in the world for me. Because when somehow, when you feel shitty about yourself, if you can talk bad shit about other people, it makes you feel better about yourself. And if you get people to agree to that, then it just makes you feel better. It's sort of like a drug, a narcotic. So I was also a self-pityaholic. That's sort of like drinking booze. Once you get involved in self-pity, you can't stop. So in any event, so there was silence at the table, and I couldn't stand silence because if there was silence, I felt uncomfortable, you know? I used to think I love people. You know, it says fear of people, you know, well, if you love people so much, how come you always have to be drunk around them? So obviously I was scared of people. Scared of their judgment, so silence I didn't like. You know, I didn't want because I figured they were thinking about me, and so I busted in when it was silent and I started talking. I said, you know that guy Bob, and I started saying something, and my sponsor Bob Sullivan turned to me. He said, you know Russell, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, you know we don't talk badly about other people behind their back. So unless you have something nice to say about Bob, why don't you just shut up? And he said that in front of a bunch of people. He like humiliated me, you know. And my mind went like on fire, you know, because I didn't like being humiliated. I started thinking about raping his wife and killing his dog. You know, where's that love and tolerance shit, you know, and all that stuff. And, you know, somebody ought to report him to AA. And I would have quit, except I had that one thing going for me that I talked about. I wanted so much not to drink. I'll tell you what. What saved my ass in here is the incredible desire not to drink. Because, believe me, if you're going to leave this place because things aren't going right or because people's going to tell you something you don't like or they're going to hurt your feelings, I would have been out of here. But I so much didn't want to drink that even though it hurt my feelings and it sort of crushed me, You know, I somehow connected that the reason that the one of the reasons I wasn't drinking is because he was my sponsor. And so I came back and I did what alcoholics do. I blended. You know, I mean that's what we do. You know, I wanted to fit in, so I wanted to fit in with them. So I stopped talking for the most part. I mean, I'm not saying I was perfect. I watched my mouth and I stopped talking about other people behind their backs. Now, there's a very interesting thing that happened. As a matter of fact, I got so insane about it, I became like the AA police force. I'd hear two people talk, and I'd say, hey, we don't do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'll tell you what happens. What happens is very interesting, an interesting deal. When you start policing your mind and start policing your mouth, and all of a sudden you're about to say, you know that guy Richard, you know, and you know you can't say it. So what happens is you sort of stop yourself from saying it. And since I like to talk, so you start figuring, well, what can I say that's nice? So so I found myself policing my mind, stopping myself from saying things in front of my sponsor and other people, you know, and I'd start saying good things. And all of a sudden, and so the next thing you know, as you start policing your mind like that, you start thinking good things about other people instead of bad things about other people. And 3 months later, I start feeling a lot better about myself. Now, you know, if my sponsor had told me, you know, Russ, if you stop talking shit about other people, maybe you'll stop thinking shit about other people and you might feel better about yourself. I would have said, what is this bullshit? You know what I mean? Because all my life, because I'm like an alcoholic, my alcoholic life, which includes my thinking, seems the only normal one. But he didn't say that to me. What he said to me, he says, why don't you just shut up? He said, and it hurt my feelings, and so I stopped doing it anyway, and I reaped the benefits. I reaped the benefits anyway. Just two more fasting stories. When I was about 10 or 11 years sober, something else I learned that was real important. I had a sponsor named Joe Snyder. My other sponsor died of cancer. And I was on the phone with him one day for about, 10 minutes talking about how my wife had done something, you know, I don't know how many people are married, but, they do shit. You know, they do shit to piss you off. They just don't listen. My wife has always been willful. You know, she spends money. She does shit. She doesn't ask me. She doesn't value my opinion. She disrespects me, all that stuff. And what does that mean? I got to stop. She disrespects me. So I turned to, I'm on the phone with her. I'm telling her she did this, she did that. I'm telling her, and then she did this, and then she did that. So after I'm done, whining and crying, because I was a member of that other fellowship, the Fellowship of the Thumb-Sucking Crybabies. You probably don't have them out here in California. We have them in droves in Dade County. So I'm talking to him, and he says, do you know why you're upset? I said, what do you mean? He says, well, do you know why you're upset? I said, what do you mean, do I know? Of course I know why I'm upset. He says, why are you upset? I said, what do you mean, why am I upset? He says, why are you upset? I said, Joe, I just spent the last 10, 15 minutes telling you verbatim in detail exactly what she did. And then there was silence, and then all of a sudden he said this. He says, you know, Russ, that's not why you're upset. And he shut up. He didn't, volunteer, you know why, or anything. So I said, that's not why I'm upset. He said, no, that's not why you're upset. And shut up. I said, that's not why I'm saying no. So he made me ask, because he knew if he had volunteered it, I would have pissed all over it. So he made me ask. I said, well, you're going to tell me why I'm upset? And then he said, well, do you really want to know? And I said, well, of course I want to know. Why I'm upset? He said, listen, stupid. He says, you're upset because you're upsettable. What is this, Zen AA or something like that? And what I found is that's true. That's part of the spiritual axiom. Whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with me. With something wrong with you. And my wife probably hasn't changed that much. I think she probably has, but she probably hasn't. There's a lot of stuff going on. But you want to know something? Most of the time, it doesn't bother me anymore. And I have one. I don't want to go past it. It's 25. I got one last story. Can I have your permission?
We have to have a group conscience.
I want to finally tell you just one story, and because this is sort of like where I'm at right now, even though it happened about 10 years ago. I was about 15 years sober. I got tapped on the shoulder, and nobody does this thing perfectly, and we all balk and do things. But I was taking a pretty good swing at the ball on this one, sponsoring people, going to meetings, doing all the service stuff, and everything like that, and. And sometimes you do all that stuff and you, You know what happens? You run into people. You know, if you keep on walking in the direction you're walking, you'll wind up where you're headed. And you'll run into somebody, and you'll be heading in a certain direction for a long period of time, and somebody will tap you on the shoulder, and all of a sudden you move like a centimeter to the right. They say, why don't you try this? And then you go in a whole different direction. And I ran into a guy, and he came up to me, and he says, Russ, have you ever gone to a Bible study? And I said, no, Bible study? I'm a Jewish kid from New York. I don't do that stuff, you know, and my Aunt Molly might disown me, and of course she'd been dead for 10 years, but I worry about shit like that, what you're gonna think about me, but I went anyway, because I somehow learned at that time that anything done out of fear probably isn't a good thing. Don't make any decisions out of fear, worry about it. So I went anyway, and I found all these guys, about 30 guys in the study. A lot of them were in AA that I loved, and that's where I met my last sponsor, who's got 57 years, he's a Baptist preacher. And so what happened was I started going to this deal, and all they were doing was studying all the shit that we were studying between 1935 and 1939. I mean, you guys know this book was written in 1939, we started in 1935. When they said, really, haven't seen a person fail, has thoroughly followed our path, they were talking about the path they were following between 35 and 39. Read Dr. Bob's Good Old Timers, he'll tell you the whole deal. So all they were doing was studying the material that they were doing between 35 and 39, so it helped me out tremendously. But the story is this. I'm driving my car, and there's a place called Pierre's Cleaners right by my house. You could see my house from Pierre's Cleaners. And I drive out, and my car has big books and 12 and 12s and Dr. Bob's and Good Old Timers and Bibles. It's just loaded with all sorts of stuff and crap on the windshield and all sorts of stuff. And I drive up to the driving thing to put my clothes in there, and there's this kid that comes out, and he's like, I don't know, he looks like he's maybe 16, 17 years old. And he's wearing, I can't explain this, we don't have any, you guys don't, I don't know whether you call him gangbangers, he's wearing his pants down to his knees. I mean, I swear, I don't even know what's holding these things up. And he's talking to me like this, with his hands like, you know, like this, and just a young kid. And he looks at me, and I hand him my stuff, and he says, you know, I got one of those. I don't know where he's pointing at. He's going like this. I got one of those. I said, one of what? One of those. And a bunch of guys, I said, you mean a Bible? He says, yeah, I got one of those. I said, you ever read it? He says, yeah, I read it. He says, you understand? He says, no, not really. I says, well, you know, sometimes you need people to sort of explain it to you. You know, the group of men. I said, I'll tell you what. I said, you know, every Thursday morning at 7:30, I go to a men's Bible study. My house is that house right across the street over there. I said, if you're at my house at 7:30, if you're there at 7:30, I'll take you over to the Bible study, and you can hang out and, you know, experience what it's like. He says, you don't realize? I said, yeah. And then I left. I did my stuff with that. I forgot all about this kid. His name was Leo. Forgot all about him. The next morning, I get up around 7:15, I'm walking out of my house, who do you think is standing by my car? Leo, with a Bible in his hand. So he gets in the car, I take him over to the Bible study, you know, we go through the study and everything like that, and we go around the room, and it's a pretty cool thing, God's pretty cool, it's non-denominational. He said one thing at the end of the Bible, he says, I think Jesus was an alien. And, you know, but those guys were like AA guys, you know, they said, hey, keep coming back, kid, everything's cool, you know. We're driving away, and he says, so what? I said, they loved you, kid. You were great and everything like that. So he says to me this. He says, could you do me a favor? Instead of taking me to your house, could you take me to my house, you know, directly to my house? I said, sure, no problem. I said, how do I get there? So he says, well, drive back to your house. And I drove back there. And he said, and we got there. And he says, okay, now drive down the stop sign. So I drove down the stop sign. And he says, now make a right. So I make a right. He says, now go down to 186th Street. So I went down to 186th Street. He says, now you got to make a left and go over to, you know, 33rd. And I made a left one over 33rd. 7 miles later, we wind up at his house. And I learned a little bit about him while I was driving with him. He's a young kid. He's like 16, 17 years old. Never had a father. His mother's with another guy now. He's got a little 3-year-old daughter, you know, that she had from another guy. And, you know, just a 16, 17-year-old kid just trying to figure out, you know, who the hell he is, just trying to make his way through life, you know, has no, like, male figure in his life or anything like that. Just a young kid, you know, just trying to figure out the deal. And so I drive him, it's like 6 or 7 miles away, and so I asked him, I said, how'd you get to my house? You know, he was there at 7:15, and it turns out he woke up at 3:30 in the morning and grabbed his Bible, and he walked the 6 miles to my house. And he got there actually earlier. He waited for me for about an hour or so. So he could go to the Bible study with me. And I do step series in Miami, you know, in Dade County and in Broward County. And I'll get in my car, I'll drive 50 miles. And once a week, what a step series, you don't have them here, where I'll do 12 weeks, you know, each step, each week. and I'll drive like around 50 miles. It takes about an hour out with a bunch of guys or something like that, and they're talking, and I'll do a little step series, and a guy will come up to me, you know, like after the step series, he says, you know, I really like what you have to say. Can I hang out? And I say, sure. I said, why don't you come down Saturday? Drive down Saturday. We have a little group that meets in Dade County, and they'll invariably look at me, and they say, well, that's pretty far. You know, that's a far way. And I said, yeah, it is far. It is far, you know, and so, you know, people ask me, you know, what does it take to get this thing, you know, and I think you got to hunger and thirst for this thing so much, sort of like Leo hungered, you know, that, I learned a lot from that kid, the way he hungered and thirsted for this sobriety thing. It's just a wonderful thing, and I really appreciate being here, and sorry about going over. God bless.